What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
I hope you're ready for another episode of America Trends. I know that John Kropczyk and I are ready for you. I'm Larry Rifkin, and I've got to tell you, you are going to be meeting an amazing man who tried to explain some things to John and to me that have dogged us for years. And John, we've had authors on before with books whose titles are provocative, but none more so than this next guest, Dr. Harlan Ullman. And the book is called Anatomy of Failure. Now, that alone isn't terribly provocative, but the subtitle, Why America Loses Every War It Starts.
Well, yeah. Well, there's a lot of wars we shouldn't have got involved in, but that's another.
Well, that's not another story. I mean, that is the story.
You know,
how did we get into these messes? Right. I know. You go from Vietnam. Well, even go back, I guess, to some extent to Korea.
Yeah.
And then you, because we still haven't settled that.
That's
I know
true.
The president said that one meeting, it's all settled.
Right.
Don't worry about it. Sleep well tonight.
But you're right.
But Korea, we still have a lot of soldiers there. And then, of course, Vietnam. And Vietnam, ultimately, I guess we made one of the cleanest breaks. And then when you think about it, there are soldiers still in Afghanistan today who, when we started in terms of the response to 9/11, they were 1 year of age at that time, and now they're over in Afghanistan.
Yeah, it's just
and frankly,
horrible.
What's shocking is the Taliban actually controls more of Afghanistan than they did 2 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I don't know how we're ever going to—I don't know what the end game for these wars are. I mean, we're just throwing money at them, and there's no win or get out or anything. I don't know.
Well, what's incredible is Dr. Ullman. Let me tell you a little bit about Dr. Harlan Ullman. He served on the senior advisory group for the Supreme Allied Commander in Europe going back from 04 to 16 and is senior advisor at Washington, D.C.'s Atlantic Council. He's a remarkable human being. He commanded a destroyer in the Persian Gulf, led over 150 missions and operations in Vietnam as a swiftboat skipper. And he really is brilliant. And what I thought was remarkable was how much he analyzed the poor civilian leadership that has led this fine military into so many situations that are unwinnable.
Well, we're all over the world. We've really become the world's police as far as just about anywhere in the world. And I don't know how many more, you know, we got a volunteer military. And I don't know how much more these guys can take of being deployed and pulled back, and it's just horrible.
And when you think about it, John, there are so few people involved in the military today, and that's why people look away almost as if this is a mercenary corps that we have now. Well, you know, they volunteered, so send them wherever. And that's one of the reasons I think we don't have the political debates that we should, why Congress has abrogated its responsibility. And when you do look at it, we have given so much power to a continuing resolution that the president can use to paper over any conflict he wants to get us into. And it's really just unfortunate, it is, the way that we have taken these lives of Americans and used them in ways that really have not furthered our own goals and objectives, or maybe we don't even know what those are.
And we've also made a lot of enemies for no reason at all, because we're going into countries and messing with, you know, in things we shouldn't even be bothered with.
Well, really. Why do we keep doing this, John? I mean, Dr. Ullman explains a lot of this. And believe me, folks, he is really clear. And he is going to get your attention on this podcast. He's got a candid assessment of the men we've been electing, to grow the imperial presidency over the years. He's none too kind about their strategic vision for war making. And our remove from the military, I think, is a really important situation, John. And we've got to think about it, because now we don't declare wars. We don't pay for wars. We don't debate the appropriateness. We don't bring folks home in time. They are, as you say, redeployed. I mean, there are so many questions that linger in our society today about our use of this great military. And we talk about how good they are, and yet we don't put them in a position to win.
Not only that, and when they come back wounded, we treat them like crap on top of it. So, I mean, you know, I don't know what's going to happen. Something's got to be done about this whole situation. We need to vote these people out.
Well, you'll want to hear Dr. Ullman, because, of course, Donald Trump said that he saw a lot of what it is we're talking about and thought that many of these were misadventures that we sent folks into and that he wanted to pull us back. Well, has he? Well, actually, really, on the ground, he's given military commanders a lot more authority. So we will talk to Dr. Ullman about that and so many other issues as part of his book tour, Anatomy of Failure, Why America Loses Every War It Starts. Don't you want to know? I do. Well, listen here to America Trends.
With us on the line is Dr. Harlan Ullman, and he is the author of the book Anatomy of Failure, Why America Loses Every War It Starts. And you have a lot of experience. Obviously, you have been in battle for the United States in Vietnam and in the Middle East. And you have the distinction of being the person who coined the term shock and awe. Is that correct?
For my sins, I plead guilty. But I must say that I was part of a group of former senior military officers, and I was the lead person in this. And the shock and awe we had designed was not the shock and awe that was so widely advertised in the 2003 Second Iraq War. Our shock and awe was based really on affecting the minds and will and perception of an adversary in which military force may or may not be necessary. And the doctrine was really as old as Sun Tzu and Clausewitz. And the idea was to defeat the enemy's strategy and to be able to win without fighting if that were possible. That didn't happen in the Second Iraq War, and unfortunately, shock and awe was given a very, very bad name because, in essence, it was overwhelming force on steroids, and that was never the intent. You can destroy an enemy, but it's far better to get an enemy to surrender than necessarily having to destroy him, and that was the objective of shock and awe, shock an enemy into incapacitation, so he had no choice but to quit.
And that gets to the thesis of your book, which is that we have not been terribly strategic in terms of the wars that we have started in the recent period. And I'm talking recent, about 50 or 60 years. And you suggest that our presidents have not been equipped to make those strategic determinations.
Yes. If you take a look at our track record in war, Korea was basically a draw because Douglas MacArthur, ego and arrogance led him up to the Yalu River and brought the Chinese in. But Vietnam was an outright loss. The Second Iraq War was an outright loss. And even smaller uses of force, the attack against Gaddafi in 2011 precipitated a civil war in Libya, which was a catastrophe for those people. And so our record, even though we have a spectacularly good military in using force, has not been very, very good. And the reasons reside in the Oval Office. Presidents we elect are inexperienced and not ready for the job, even though Jack Kennedy said cynically, there is no school for presidents. But certainly the last four presidents, Kennedy himself, Jimmy Carter, and to some degree Ronald Reagan, were really not ready for the demands of the job, and not all of them learned as they went. Second, they failed to exercise good strategic judgment, in part because they were following campaign promises or ideology or groupthink or political expediency. John Kennedy wanted to pay any price, bear any burden, and saw a monolithic threat in Southeast Asia in which the communists were going to take over. Lyndon Johnson wanted to stop the commies on the Mekong and not the Mississippi. George W. Bush wanted to change the geostrategic landscape of the greater Middle East by democratizing Iraq. He did, but not for the better. And so when you have presidents who don't exercise sound strategic judgment, and George H.W. Bush, the 41st president, did on numerous occasions, then you have the recipe for disaster. And finally, our presidents are not always as knowledgeable and understanding of the situations in which we are using force. Before September 11th, very few Americans knew the difference between Sunnis and Shias. Yet we've been at war for 18 years in Afghanistan, similarly in Iraq. And during the Vietnam conflict, we did not understand the issues in Vietnam, a civil war, a war for unification, and an ideological war. And so as a result, when we lacked knowledge and understanding, we made poor strategic judgments, and that was reinforced by the inexperience of presidents. And so our record since the end of World War II in using force has, quite frankly, been pretty poor.
We'll return to this episode of America Trends in just a moment. If you like what we're doing here at America Trends Podcast, please don't keep it to yourself. I know there are a lot of people, John, who think, well, if I'm listening and somebody else wants to listen at the same time, maybe we're going to collide and they're not going to be able to hear us.
Yeah.
Is that the way the technology works?
No, there's plenty of bandwidth. Everybody can listen at the same time.
All right. Well, that dispels that myth. Now, you can do a number of things that would really be helpful to us. You could give us a kind rating or a review at Apple Podcasts, and that boosts what they consider to be our value and visibility. And what does that do, John?
Well, that puts us in the forefront so that you can find us easier, and most important is other people can find us easier.
And you can subscribe there or on our site, americatrendspodcast.com, or wherever you're listening, so we can alert you to new episodes of the podcast, which, by the way, we put out twice a week on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And stay in touch with us on both Facebook and Twitter at Trends Podcast. Or you can like us on Facebook or follow us where, John?
On Twitter.
On Twitter. Yeah. That's right. Where the world turns to hear fake news or whatever it is. Well, you can direct message us at Trends Podcast or using hashtag Trends Podcast. And you know, John, with our growing audience, and really it's been pretty remarkable, a lot of people just came to us the last month or two, and they might have missed earlier episodes. Can they get them again?
They can look through them and pick the ones they want to listen to. They're all on the website, and a lot of them are up on iTunes, many of them.
All right. Well, listen, there's lots of material to listen to. We hope you have the time, and we'll lend it to us because we try to make it worth your while. And thanks so much for listening.
And tell your friends.
We now return to this episode of America Trends.
You exempt George H.W. Bush in that, and you applaud him for some of his decision-making and his restraint. Just give us the examples.
Well, first of all, when Bush came in 1989, there was the issue in Panama when President Noriega of Panama was threatening Americans and actually killed an American, and so we intervened. It was a massive intervention. It wasn't necessarily smooth, but we got in, got out, and Panama was put on a better track. But most importantly, when the Cold War ended and the Berlin Wall came down, President Bush was responsible for making Europe whole, free, and at peace with the unification of Germany, providing funds to Russia so that it would not go bankrupt, and he manipulated that period brilliantly. And when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait in August of 1990, Bush was brilliant in putting together, along with Jim Baker and Colin Powell, who was chairman of the Joint Chiefs, a great coalition that drove Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait, destroyed the Iraqi army. We had a coalition of 50 or 60 countries along with us, including Russia, including our NATO allies, including the Egyptians, including the Saudis. And by the way, Japan paid for most of the operations. And so that was masterful. And anybody who criticized George H.W. Bush not going for Baghdad should have learned their lessons in 2003 when his son did. Yet, for all of his qualities and performance, unfortunately, George H.W. Bush did not get a second term.
Interesting. Ronald Reagan, a lot of people give him credit for his foreign policy, and yet you believe that he wrongly thought that he could bankrupt the Soviet Union by engaging in an arms race, and he blundered into Beirut.
Well, not only that. First of all, what happened with the Soviet Union was you had a gerontocracy. I was at the War College, National War College in Washington, D.C. from 1975 to late 1978, and every year the director of the CIA, Bill Covey, would come in saying, Leonid Brezhnev, the head of the Soviet Union, is dying. He's got six more months. Well, that six more months went on for many years, and then he was relieved or replaced by the walking dead, Chernyako, and then Andropov. And finally, into this mix came young Mikhail Gorbachev. And Mikhail Gorbachev saw that the Soviet Union was a disaster, and through glasnost and perestroika, that is to say openness and restructuring, he thought he could reform it. This had nothing to do with the Reagan defense buildup, and unfortunately for the Soviet Union, reform and daylight destroyed it. So this was really a function of what was happening in the Soviet Union and not Reagan. And as far as foreign policy, you remember he mined the waters against the law illegally in Nicaragua, and then just after the 241 Marines and service personnel were killed in the Beirut bombing in October 1983, he went into Grenada on the grounds of protecting 221 American students at St. George's Hospital and preventing the Cubans from building an air base that was going to be used for the by the Soviets. But the operational commander radioed back from Grenada that the students were not in jeopardy, and the base was actually being built by a British corporation who had hired the low-cost bidder, Cuban workers, with a proviso that Cuba would provide guards so the workers didn't escape. And this was being done in line with British policy to increase tourism in Grenada that began in the late 1960s. And ironically, Maggie Thatcher, then the Prime Minister of Britain, called Reagan the night before the invasion and said, "Ronnie, I hope you're not planning to invade Grenada, as I am told. We were having a huge problem because at that stage the Americans were reintroducing missiles into Europe to prevent the Russians from using their SS-20 intermediate-range missiles. And so Maggie Thatcher was having a tremendous political fight to get cruise missiles stationed in Greenham Common. And Reagan said in his memoir, "Well, I had to lie to Maggie Thatcher and said, of course we're not going in. What else could I say?" But this makes my point. Grenada was a tiny issue, but we went in for the wrong reasons because we did not do our homework. And fortunately, it was not a disaster.
And Dr. Ullman, many people look back at Bill Clinton and say, well, what happened with Serbia to stop the killing of those in Kosovo was a good bombing campaign, and it was rather clean in terms of American losses. But you say that 78 days that it took us, it could have been done in hours with a different
approach. Absolutely. I fault Clinton for a number of reasons. You will recall after he took office in 1993, there was Black Hawk Down in Somalia when 18 Special Forces troops were killed because we failed to give the troops in Somalia sufficient forces, namely M1 tanks and C-130 gunships. But in Kosovo in 1999, to stop Slobodan Milosevic, we began a bombing campaign. Well, the fact of the matter is the bombing campaign achieved very little. The Serbian army was brilliant at camouflage and deception, so we destroyed very little despite exaggerated reports of knocking out tanks and artillery pieces. It took 78 days, and it was only after the Russians threatened to put boots on the ground did Milosevic capitulate. Here's the best military in the world, the strongest alliance in the world, taking 78 days to force a tin pot dictator to cease and desist. Shame on us. It should have been done in hours and at most a few days. And the only target of consequence, by the way, we hit was the Chinese embassy in Belgrade.
Have we put too much responsibility and authority into the National Security Council and the president, or should it rest there and not in the military? You remind us that the military is there to operationalize the strategy of the president, and yet this president has a very strong National Security Council advisor, or a couple of them already, Donald Trump, and he is looking, though, to give more responsibility for what happens on the ground to those who are in the field. Help us square that circle.
One of the problems is because our military is so good, it is asked to perform duties that it cannot. In Vietnam, it was going to nation build. It could not do that. In Afghanistan, it was going to nation build. It could not. And similarly in Iraq. So the military, because it is so competent, but it's competent in using military force against military targets. And when you want to push it to do things that are can only be accomplished politically, diplomatically, and in the civilian sector, it's not going to work. And so when I argue in my book, Anatomy of Failure, we need to put some checks on the NSC. And one of the things I argue for is creating a red team, which challenges all the assumptions that are going to be made while we are considering the use of force. Does Iraq really have weapons of mass destruction? Are we really getting ourselves into a quagmire in Vietnam? What are we trying to do drawing red lines in Syria about use of chemical weapons? we don't do that. And more importantly, we have to bring the Congress in. And to do that, I argue that Congress ought to have its own National Security Council that consists of the 8 or 10 most senior members of both the House and the Senate, the Vice President of the United States, who's the only official who has actual responsibilities, both branches, namely the executive branch and in the Congress, where he's president of Senate, chairs it. And presumably that group will have a good staff, and it should liaise very, very closely with the White House so that Congress is in on the takeoff if it's going to be present on the landing. I think those two things are very, very necessary to bring back a better balance so that presidents who are inexperienced, and the last four presidents were extraordinarily inexperienced, although I will say by the end of his second term, George W. Bush had turned into quite a competent president, even though his first term and a half was disastrous. But presidents don't always learn, and so I think Congress has got to play a better role, and the National Security Council has to be able to examine its critical assumptions much more closely.
In our political system, we must have some kind of deficiency, because you say that our policymakers need far greater knowledge and understanding of conditions in which force is to be used and not to be used. Why are they lacking so much of that critical judgment, understanding of history, the terrain, of the cultures that we're talking about here?
Well, part of the problem is that they're not really experienced. You take a look at our last four presidents. I mean, what were Bill Clinton's qualifications, or George W. Bush, or Barack Obama, or now Donald Trump? They had very, very few. And so it's very difficult because time is a big issue. There's bandwidth. There are bandwidth problems. Making sure presidents and certainly their staffs are well educated.
So you say that the U.S. keeps electing these poorly qualified presidents. Is there another measure that we can take in our political dialogue? I know sometimes we have a debate only on foreign policy, and the American public has greater or lesser interest in those foreign affairs than they do what's going to happen to my pocketbook. How much of this do you lay at the doorstep of the American public?
Well, I think that the American political process is broken, and I think that a system of checks and balances invented by the best minds of the 18th century may not function in the 21st century when civility and compromise are gone. And the reason civility and compromise are gone is because both political parties have gravitated to the extreme left and the extreme right, and the center has really been overtaken and is not represented. And so therefore we get people who represent very, very narrow slices. Lots of good people really don't want to run. And quite frankly, the fundamental issue is the Constitution only has four requirements for president. You've got to be 35, live 14 years in the United States, be a natural-born citizen, whatever that means, and get a majority of electoral votes. Judgment, character, experience, intellect, common sense are not requirements. And so as long as we don't have specific requirements in terms of experience and the things that I measured, the chances of getting a really able president in the future are very, very questionable. And I would say in the past, among the best presidents were Richard Nixon, who was destroyed by Watergate, and George H.W. Bush, who didn't get a second term, and probably Gerry Ford, if he had an opportunity to serve in a first term or a second term. But after Watergate, it was really impossible for a Republican to overcome Richard Nixon.
Please weigh in on the notion that the American citizenry is so divorced from what's going on with the military because there is no draft, and most of the individuals are coming from a very small swath of the American public, so they don't have a lot of skin in the game.
It's a real problem, and actually, though we've been at war for extended periods since 2001, our casualties have been relatively light, obviously not for people who have been killed or wounded or their families. And so this is not like Vietnam, where we had 58,000 Americans killed, or World War II, where we had 300,000. And so the public is quite tolerant. And yes, it is a problem because militaries are shrinking and consolidating around a smaller number of large bases. And so the interaction between Americans and their military is very much more limited. And that produces a problem. I think in the future, because the cohort, that is the number of people eligible for military service, is shrinking, whether due to physical disabilities, legal problems, and other such disqualifying factors, there's going to be more intense competition just to be able to recruit. And at some stage, we may have to go to a hybrid force where we have people who volunteer and remain professionals and people who are drafted. And I think the advantage of that is that you introduce more people into the military, and you might have draftees into the National Guard and reserves, but I think we have to have a larger base from which to draw people in the military, because the base is shrinking and because I think that the American military is becoming isolated. Not that it wants to be, but reality is pushing it in that direction.
Dr. Harlan Ullman is with us. The book is called Anatomy of Failure, Why America Loses Every War It Starts. With this particular presidency, where we are getting a lot more money thrown at the Pentagon, and that was one thing that Donald Trump said that he wanted to do. At the same time, he said that he wanted to be very restrained in the use of that force. Have you seen those factors coming together in a way that makes sense as to what he's intending going forward in his term?
First of all, the American senior leadership, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, have been begging Congress for the last 3 or 4 years about the state of the American military, which is not good. They have been forthright, and they have been direct. And indeed, the chief of the staff of the Army went so far to call Congress derelict if they didn't pass a budget relying on continual resolutions, which have been destroying the fiber of the military. Because of the nature of this particular Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis, and his huge credibility, Congress is going to appropriate about $1.5 trillion for defense over the next 2 years, or in excess of $700 billion a year. But Congress expects that the readiness problems and all the shortfalls in procurement are going to be fixed. That is not going to happen, because after being at war for 17 years, readiness, procurement, all these things have been suffering to be able to pay for the costs of war. And so in 2 years' time, when our deficits and debt are accumulating, when interest rates go up, the military budget is not going to be sustainable. And unless we take strong action now, we are going to have a hollow force, much as we had after the Vietnam War, simply because the demands and requirements we're putting on our military are not going to receive sufficient amounts of money. And this is a great problem, and it's going to be increased in terms of its difficulty, because Congress and the public will expect, as I said earlier, that this amount of extra spending will alleviate the problems, and it will not. The Army has 58 brigade combat teams around which it's organized. 3 brigade combat teams are ready to fight right now. The Air Force is short 2,000 pilots. Half of the operational aircraft, F-18s and F-35s, deployed in the Navy right now are not. In other words, the operational rate is at 50%. The collisions that people remember that took place in the Pacific with American destroyers were not accidents in the sense these things were due because of training, maintenance, and other deficiencies, because we did not have sufficient money to look after our forces. And so my great concern, and I think one of the greatest dangers we face right now, more so than Russia and China, because we're exaggerating them as military threats, is that we risk the American military devolving into a hollow force. And if we do, shame on us.
How frustrated are people in the military with the inept nature of the civilian leadership?
The military follow orders. That's one of the things about the United States. And I don't mean this in a sense where they do stupid things, but they do respect civilian leadership. And they're very silent about criticizing their seniors. But I think they realize that they are not well led necessarily by this president, but they had reservations about prior presidents simply because presidents make mistakes, and when they do, the military are going to bear the cost of that. But we do have civilian control, that is unquestioned, and there's loyalty to the commander-in-chief rather than to the individual who may be president.
You want a brains-based approach, and you don't leave that only at the doorstep of the current occupant of the Oval Office. You say that ignorance of the local situation is embedded in our decision-making DNA. Too often American leaders have believed that the enemy is always thinking as we do, and you're saying that our forces sometimes lack cultural knowledge of the enemy.
That's absolutely true. In Vietnam, we were clueless. When I was training to go to Vietnam to prepare for the jungles, I train in the mountains of Southern California in the middle of the winter when frostbite was the issue, not an enemy. Well, frostbite was the enemy. The last time there was snow in Vietnam, I suspect, was during the Ice Age. The brains-based approach is meant to do three things. First, we have to understand the 21st century is far different than the 20th century. The 20th century was largely binary. It was World War I, Allies versus the Central Powers, World War II, Allies versus the Axis, and the Cold War, East versus West, United States and its allies against the Soviet Union. Today, the world is far more complex. You have individuals such as Bin Laden or Edward Snowden who become real threats. You have non-state actors, the Islamic State or Al-Qaeda. And then you have many, many countries that are becoming more and more capable, not only militarily, but through cyber and through the Internet, that can become real problems. And so we have to realize that what served us well in the 20th century cannot necessarily work in the 21st century. And ideas like containment and deterrence, which worked in a binary or bipolar world, are not working very well. How do you deter the Russians, for example, from interfering in our politics, or China from militarizing small islands in the various China seas? So we need a new concept and construct for the 21st century, and I offer one. Second, we have to focus on affecting will and perception of the particular target to get people to do what we want or to stop doing things that we don't. This is the basis of shock and awe. And finally, we need to pursue a continuous process of knowledge and learning and understanding. This is probably our weakest element, that we simply believe that people think like us or act like us, and we are culturally too often ignorant. This was true in Vietnam. It was certainly true in Iraq and the Middle East. It was true in Afghanistan. And I'm sure it's true in Yemen and other places we are actively engaged. And so this is an issue that is going to be very difficult to resolve, but unless or until we have far greater understanding. And I go back to the Granada case, which in a sense was almost a satire, because every reason we went in was wrong. And the question is, why didn't we challenge those assumptions? And that's why I argue we need to have a red team permanently assigned in the NSC staff in the White House to make sure that we get the assumptions right and we do know what we're doing.
How long can we countenance this willful indifference to the way the world operates, or setting ourselves apart, or thinking that our knowledge base is superior and we really don't have to understand the complexities of the world in which we're operating militarily?
I think that the answer to that, Larry, is simply this. The issues are not existential. Russia and China or the Islamic State and radical Islam do not pose existential threats to us, no matter how we think they may. What's going to happen, however, is that our standard of living will decline and the gap between rich and poor will increase in the United States, and the expectation of the American dream will become more elusive. Now, we can deal with this. This is not cancer, which is fatal. This is a bad case of the flu, which is uncomfortable. And at some stage, when that level of discomfort becomes so great, then maybe we'll take action. So at this stage, my view is that the situation is serious, but not deadly. And as bad as our government may be, we will muddle through. But that does not necessarily make things better for the United States, our standard of living, or for the overall stability and peaceful prospects for the world at large. We can make a change if we so decide to do so, but it's going to take understanding and knowledge that the world is far different than we see it. It's going to take courage to take steps and policies which are not going to be popular, and realizing that the United States is now part of a world in which its influence and its power are diminished, and we have to learn to play with that. It's rather like a football team that depended on a power offense of high diddle-diddle right up the middle, and all of a sudden the line has gone from 300 pounds down to 220, and they have to adopt a new offense. That's what we have to do. We have to adopt a new strategy to deal with the fact is that we're not as powerful economically, militarily, or diplomatically as we once were, even though we still are the strongest in the world. We need a different strategy for the 21st century.
In closing, when you look at the cyber threats and attacks on the United States, you look at North Korea and the threat that we are told that poses to us, what do you look at on the horizon immediately that you see as a great concern that we need to address, perhaps in a different way?
My greatest concern is our ability to govern. My view is that our government is broken, and the biggest problem we face is here. We've exaggerated threats continuously. North Korea is a lesser threat, and I've made this argument for a long time. Kim Jong-un now believes, wrongly, that he is at strategic parity with the United States because he has achieved some kind of nuclear capacity and some kind of means to threaten the United States. So he is prepared to negotiate. This had nothing to do with Donald Trump's threats or anything else. He's just at a stage where negotiation makes sense. We have to understand that. Similarly, in dealing with Russia, yes, Russia's active measures have got to be opposed much more strongly. We've got to do it not so much with sanctions, but changing the cost exchange ratio so that it's far more expensive for Russia to do things than it has than the cost that they're paying right now. So I worry about home. I worry about an unbalanced budget. I worry about a national debt that is growing by $1 trillion a year. I worry about a continued disparity between rich and poor and the cost of the diminution of the middle class, the expense of college, of health care, of retirement. Too many families are working too many jobs at the same time. And America, while still has the potential to remain the greatest country in the world, unless we do far better at governing, that potential, unfortunately, in my mind, is going to subside and be reduced. And to me, that's the greatest danger we threat. We face the threats overseas we can deal with no matter how incompetent we are.
Dr. Harlan Ullman, and I don't mean to be gratuitous, but I worry about the same things that you do. Anatomy of Failure, Why America Loses Every War It Starts. Thank you for starting with us and continuing until you were able to explain your thinking, which is really something that we needed to hear today on America Trends. Thank you.
Larry, thank you very much.